This podcast is hosted by Chris Finkston and Spencer Oliver. They are both experienced paramedics. They've done everything from 911 ground ambulance to volunteer fire department work and are both currently flight paramedics. This podcast reviews scenarios based on real calls run by real out-of-hospital clinicians. Details are changed to protect the privacy of those involved and to present educational opportunities to the listener. This podcast is EMS 2020. Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of EMS 2020. I think it's going to be an exciting episode. I am bringing all the words today, and Spencer is going to be in the hot seat. Not really, though. I'm going to preface that so, Spencer, you can relax a little bit. I don't think there's anything here that's going to be too terrible.
I was going to say, I feel like I worked last night. I worked all day. I'm tired. So,
hey,
like,
ladies and
you putting me in the hot seat is essentially like, hey, I'm going to toss this fish into a barrel and shoot it. Bet I hit it.
See, I don't know. I think right now, if we were to run a 12 lead on you, the diagnosis that would come out would just say a whole shitload of excuses. So anyway, update on Hop's beer. We're working on it. That's all we have to say. I still think it's going to happen because I want to believe, but we're working on it.
I want to believe.
Yeah, we've had a lot of people try and help us out. I believe we have a message that we just need to get around to, and that is someone is working on is going to help us with the logistics of shipping beer. So that may be helpful. Part of this is I have to get off my ass and really look into how to get beer to me.
Look who's printing out excuses from the monitor now.
Excuse me, that's not an excuse. That's owning it. If you were to just say, hey, I suck and it's my fault, you know what? The monitor would just say, you know what? Sinus tachycardia. But, all right, guys, but before we get too far into this episode, we have a correction, or an addition, rather, to our last episode that was brought up by one of our listeners on our Facebook page. Shannon Sanchez.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Shannon Sanchez noted that we glossed over reproductive history in the patient. So the patient from last week's episode, Gut Feeling, presented with lower left abdominal pain and lower left quadrant abdominal pain, rather. And ultimately, the crew ends up missing a diagnosis and the patient ends up dying. The episode's definitely a very good listen. But one of the things that we glossed over was asking reproductive history because the patient's fairly old. They're in their 80s. Shannon points out that provided the patient hasn't had her ovaries removed, there very well could have been an ovarian cyst that would have caused very much similar symptoms. So I went and researched that, and it turns out Shannon Sanchez, our listener, is totally right. Not only could it have been a cyst in people over the age of 80 that still have their ovaries, they are the most common group to have ovarian cysts.
That was a surprising fact for me.
Yeah, but
I learned something today.
Yeah, I found that out. There was an article in Oncology Times that actually talked about this. So that is where we caught it. And so, yeah, it was not only is it absolutely true, and we shouldn't have glossed over reproductive history just because of age, it actually helps drive the point home. One of the main points that we made was that there are a lot of things that aren't serious that could otherwise mask something that is serious. And we didn't really end up finding the crew at too much fault for missing the serious diagnosis. And this is an exact reason why. The patient did not have a bunch of the, I guess you would say, the typical markers of the ultimate diagnosis they ended up with. And they had things that kind of mimicked other problems. And this was another problem that could have mimicked the symptoms that our patient had. And so our patient's complaint was lower left quadrant abdominal pain. And and if you have a cyst on the left side, that's how it will present on the left ovary. So yeah, good catch, Shannon Sanchez.
It's call time.
All right, yeah, so the call. So this call actually comes to us, and I love this. It comes to us from a QAQI committee member. It's a rough call, no lie. But what I really like about these calls is we tend to get a lot more detail because it's gone through like a QAQI process, and they've gone out and gathered info. So it's cool. Like, the level of detail we have is great. That being said, the call, less cool. I will give you a quick spoiler here at the beginning. Though, frankly, at this point, if you've been listening for any amount of time to this show, you know what to expect. Things are going to go wrong. Now, that said, not every call we do is what the, you know, something where things go wrong, like I See Dead People and the right Way to Do Things Wrong. Those are two good examples where things went actually really right. But yeah. Today's call is not that, and it's not only going to highlight failures at the crew level. There may be some system level failures as well, which is kind of why we're being brought in. We have everything. Oh. Yeah. So there's everything in this from, I would say possibly there's some bias regarding pain medication administration. There's what I think is rampant confirmation bias. So Spencer, I'm actually really, curious as to how you feel about some of the things that go on. And there may be even some good old-fashioned turning of the blind eye. So, yeah.
Oh, good. It's got all the things.
Absolutely. So let's get to it.
Let me guess real quick. They didn't check a CBG. The fucking monsters. They had one job and couldn't do it. Is that it?
So fun story. They actually did not check a CBG. It doesn't save anything, but they didn't check a CBG. That much is true. So our system, the system that we are in is a rural EMS system, not like super rural. There is enough call volume to support a private ambulance company that holds onto the ambulance service area or the ambulance service agreement for the area. Though much of the revenue actually comes from long interfacility transports going from smaller hospitals to larger resource hospitals in a large nearby city that's over an hour away. So today's call is going to center around one such interfacility transport. The person submitting the story felt that while the process was thorough, the QAQI process, that is, and the review actually included input from the sending hospital, who also did their own internal QAQI process on this as well, they feel that the end result focused too much on the crew and not enough on the system. And so let's kind of see how we feel, see if that's true.
Hold on, do they need to supply their own batteries for their glucometers? Because then I kind of side with them on the system thing.
Yeah. No, I don't think that's going to be the problem today. And really quick, so before we get too far into this, I do want to call out that there's going to be some big issues in this call. And Spencer and I are very, very careful to make sure that we try not to place direct judgment on people as people. And we try and look at, you know, okay, clinically where they can improve. But I got to tell you, there are some things that are going to come up. And I want to remind everyone that listens to this show that we receive these calls from other people and they tell us what they tell us. And we only have one part of the story. So just as we acknowledge, as we say it, please acknowledge as you listen that you're only hearing one half of a very complicated story. And if this half doesn't necessarily paint a particular group of paramedics or responders in a positive light, again, get that it's just one half. And that's also why we do our due diligence to make sure that we anonymize enough of a story to where you can't really pin it on any one person. We are very dedicated to protecting the patient and the responder's privacy. So with that said, let's go ahead and move on. So, but before we even introduce the crews, let's talk about our patient. And our patient shall be dubbed Jerry. Jerry is 43 years old. He is, I would call it semi-homeless. They have no permanent residence, but they kind of bounce between like friends' houses. And okay. 2 days prior to the call, he walked into the emergency room because he had a sore just above his left heel. So anyway, he was complaining of severe pain. Now, here's an important social history that will play a role, or I feel it plays a role anyway. Jerry is an admitted known narcotic seeker, and he has a history of prescription and heroin abuse. So when Jerry went in for a sore on his foot, he was not given any pain medicine by the emergency room. In addition to this, Jerry was noted to have a mild fever, slight tachycardia, and a pretty gross-looking sore on his heel. He was not given antibiotics at the emergency room, but was given a prescription for antibiotics. Now, details here as to whether or not he should have received them at the hospital, if he filled his prescription, we don't have those kind of details. And honestly, like, what kind of treatments he should have received at the hospital, it's kind of out of our wheelhouse. And we really don't have the details of any other assessment that was done there to say that they should have given him some at the hospital or not. Because I don't know what would trip that trigger. So what we're going to focus on is actually what happens next. 2 days later, Jerry returns to the ER. This time, though, he's hobbling. He waits in the lobby for about an hour. and it's kind of humorous on how we know that later on, before a bed is available to him. Jerry is complaining of severe pain and is feeling extremely ill. He says that his left heel has not improved, and upon exam in the emergency room, a nurse finds a super gross, foul-smelling sore, and it's just looking awful. The whole distal portion of his left extremity is red, it's swollen, and any palpation of the leg at all just elicits incredible pain from Jerry.
Ooh, yeah. That's not good.
No, it's not. The patient is also noticed to be substantially uncooperative. He's swearing at people. He's just being kind of a jerk, and he is agitated. So vital signs in the emergency room are as follows. Per the ambulance agency's chart, I just want to let, that's kind of important here. This is not, the QAQI committee did not get this information from the emergency room. This is what the ambulance crew documented as prior to arrival vital signs when they went to pick up the patient. So skin, pale and dry. Temp 38.7, which is febrile, by the way. I want to say it's like 102.5 or 101. It's around 102. Anyway, heart rate is 132. Blood pressure, unobtainable. Noted, it's unobtainable due to patient compliance. Respiratory rate, noted tachypnea, but no other details. Glasgow coma score is 15. You can't get a 16, so that's pretty good. SAO2 is 95% on room air, and end-tidal CO2 is not being monitored.
Quick question for you. Yeah. Did they get the fact that it was unobtainable? Is that what the, do we know, is that what the, like the sending RN said, or did they try and hit one and like have the same, like get that problem?
That is actually what the ER was getting. What was happening is it wasn't like he wouldn't let them put a blood pressure cuff on. She just felt that he was agitated and wouldn't stay still. And so it was either giving weird numbers or question marks.
Gotcha.
And okay. So instead of document those, they just said, yeah, we're not able to get an accurate one here because the patient's not sitting still for us. At least that was what that's the report they got from the emergency room.
Okay, gotcha.
So anyway, although the patient was apparently uncooperative with a blood pressure cuff, the patient did allow for two large bore IVs and blood work to be done.
Huh.
So yeah, blood work came back with substantially elevated white blood cell count and indicators of poor kidney function as well. In spite of no obtainable blood pressure, the physician ended up ordering fluid administration get started right away, as well as some IV antibiotics. So, okay, Spence, let's kind of break right here. I know you already probably have a few things to say. I'm going to note right off the bat, if you're waiting for the part where they treat the guy's pain, or if you think maybe I missed that, I did not miss it, and they did not treat his pain. So okay. I will just throw that out there. But give me kind of a quick overview of like what you're thinking right now.
I'm thinking things aren't really adding up very well. I mean, like a guy who's willing to, who won't cooperate for a blood pressure, but is like just cool with having two large bore IVs put in and having blood work done. It's not really right. Adding up very well. I'm thinking that the blood pressure is probably low, given that, you know, like, the top of my list is sepsis. He's got the infection. He's got signs that seem to match that. So, I guess even given the benefit of the doubt that this elusive blood pressure was due to his lack of cooperation, I still think trying to get a blood pressure is important. And, you know, if they're making the argument that, like, pain and anxiety are barriers to getting that information or being able to accurately get that information to kind of pick a treatment paradigm, then it seems like that would kind of be you would want to address that barrier. So I don't see how they're really doing that.
I agree with you. And I know that some of our listeners are probably kind of hesitant about giving like anxiolytics or a narcotic to someone with potentially low blood pressure. But I think you and I both probably have some counterpoints to that in mind. And I am happy to see, though, that in spite of no blood pressure, they do recognize that the patient is septic, because that's the route they're going down, right? I mean, IV antibiotics, tachypnea, you know, those kind of things.
Yeah.
They recognize that he is septic and fluid depleted. And so anyway, let's put a pin in this particular thing and we'll circle back later on with that. So, all right.
Okay.
So due to the patient's decrease in kidney function and his sepsis, the ER opts to transfer the patient to a large resource hospital in the middle of Big City called Big City General Hospital and Shopping Mall. So they call for and here's the thing, like, you know what I'm talking about, Spence. Like, the bigger the hospital when you go into, yeah, like, not like the ER entrance, but like the normal entrance. Like, you go in there, there's like cafes and gift shops, and that's how you know that you've arrived. That's how you know you've arrived at a hospital. It's not your cath lab. It's not your ability to do ECMO. It's not your NICU. It's the miniature strip mall that you have in front.
It's what you, yeah, it's what you have. It reminds me of the, like, the urgent cares that they'll like, oh yeah, you can, you just text and we'll let you know when your appointment is and you can shop around the mall that we're located in. And then we'll just give you a heads up.
Could you imagine being sitting at like a Buffalo Wild Wings? You're just trying to time it. You're just like, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. I need my wings. I need my wings. Who's going to be first? Doctor, wings, doctor, wings. Anyway, so they call for a local ambulance company and they get an advanced life support crew consisting of three people. The first person is Waffles. Waffles, the paramedic, is the only paramedic on the crew, and he comes in with about 4 years of experience, all within the same system.
Ooh.
And he rarely do paramedics in this system work with other paramedics. So prior to these 4 years as a paramedic, he was an EMT basic with a volunteer fire department in the same area for about a year. Okay. So his partner is Pancakes. Pancakes is an EMT basic that has been with the agency for about 10 months. He is described as an overtime glutton and generally a very good EMT basic. His prior experience to this agency is not exactly known, but this is not his first EMS agency. And the third is Scone. Scone is an EMT basic. Scone is, which really, like, the other two can make a complete breakfast. This guy's half a breakfast. Because Scone is an EMT basic who has applied to the agency, passed his initial interview, and is now doing a ride-along as part of the new hire process. He is an employee, but is prohibited from driving until he completes his first month of FTEP, which is a training program, field training. Stands for Field Training Evaluation Program, if you're curious. He has only been employed at this agency for about a week, but has worked at the same volunteer fire department that Waffles did prior to this agency for about 7 months. Our crew responds code 3, that's lights and sirens, to the emergency room. They take their IV pumps, monitor, oxygen, and stretcher. When they find Jerry, he's alert, oriented, and angry. So he is ANO times 5.
Well, 5, of course. Yeah. You get the extra point for being angry.
Yeah, exactly. You're alert and oriented, person, place, time, and event, and what is pissing you off right now. Jerry's basically sitting there, and he is complaining to the crew that he had to wait in the lobby for an hour just to be taken to a hospital that he doesn't want to go to. And the RN gives a handoff to the crew, stating that they would like them to continue the fluid therapy en route.
Oh, what fluids are they on? Normal saline or LR. Lactate ringers?
Lactate ringers. The fluid of choice when it comes to sepsis. So the second leader is just about done. So the guy's already had about 2 liters. And they go to transfer the patient over to the gurney. They wait for the second leader to stop, and they go ahead and just start the third leader right then and there, and they move on out to the ambulance. They briefly stop at the desk to get some paperwork and then shuffle on. So Waffles and Scone hop in the back while Pancakes takes the driver's seat. The crew's first set of vitals that they documented after initiating transport are as follows. Heart rate, 136. Respiratory rate is listed as 30, but the crew notes unlabored. 30 sucks.
30's fast.
Yeah, it is. End-tidal CO2 is not monitored. SAO2 is 97%, and the crew notes that they placed the patient on a nasal cannula at this point, because remember, they're 94% on room air, but they also note there's a poor waveform on the monitor. So EKG shows sinus tach with no ectopy. GCS is still 15. And, fun story, they also note that the blood pressure is unobtainable due to the patient's compliance.
Huh.
In the back of the ambulance. Okay. Yeah. So now, a little bit of a time shift here. When the QAQI committee spoke with Pancakes after this call, Pancakes, who was the driver, stated that he drove a slow code 3 as the trip was mostly freeway, and he was under the impression that the patient was stable and that code 3 was mostly a red tape maneuver at this point. So, which I'll tell you this much, when it is mostly freeway, I think Spencer and I kind of agree, like, unless it's wide open freeway and you really need to get going, like, code 3 doesn't save you a ton of time anyway. Lights and sirens doesn't. So, anyway, when Waffles was asked what the monitor was stating and, like, what unobtainable meant, his statement was that whenever they tried to get a blood pressure, they would get either the ? Over ? Or, and this is a quote, wacky numbers. He did not recall what the wacky numbers were, and the logs on the monitor when they went to review for that day were not present. Now, nothing nefarious here. The logs are routinely cleared to conserve storage space on the monitor. I know agencies that I've worked at have had basically routine monitor checks either at the start of the week or start of the day where you clear the logs because they will fill up the memory. So anyway, nothing nefarious, but they weren't there. So,
okay. Well, I'm glad they clarified what unobtainable meant, because that, that was kind of an unsettling statement. But okay, so they're not getting it. It's getting question marks or wacky numbers. Did they try and troubleshoot at all?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
So, I mean, from what I know, I mean, yeah, I don't know if they repositioned the blood pressure cuff. I think they just hit the button again and again, but I don't have that information. They do what most of us do.
Random number generate.
I don't like that blood pressure. Hit another one. So the vitals are consistently trended for the next 20 minutes of the transport with no real major changes. Heart rate is pretty variable between like the high 120s and the low 130s. Everything else stays about the same with one exception. The patient becomes somewhat less agitated, as is noted next to one set of vital signs. And in that set of vital signs, the heart rate had hit its lowest number of 119. Still, GCS is documented at 15, and the patient is still alert, times 5. Anyway, so they also make an interesting note as the third liter is nearing completion. If you include the time from when they started in the ER plus the transport time, it's been going on for probably about 30 to 35 minutes. I did the math on this, and you know, that's pretty fast for a full liter to go in, but it's not out of the realm of possibility. That you'd need about 7 drops a second is what you would need for a full liter to go in about 35 minutes, which is pretty much wide open. I mean, if you divided 1 second into 7 parts and tried to get a drip, that's pretty much too fast to really perceive looking at, but certainly within the realm of flow.
Yeah, well, he's got 2 large bore IVs, so I mean, you know, I'm imagining if they're large, one of them's going to flow super smooth. So
yeah, so right. Anyway, so they're just dumping a liter in the third liter in the guy. All right, so Spencer, we are about 3 liters in. What, considering the vitals that we kind of have, what direction are you starting to consider treatment-wise? What's going through your head?
Well, I mean, I'd really like a blood pressure, honestly. I think 3 liters in with a calmer patient, we'd be able to get an accurate one by now.
Right.
Usually the fluid course for like a septic patient is like 30 mils per kilogram. I don't know how much this guy weighs. I don't know where we're at. But if we're nearing that kind of marker and we're still not getting a blood pressure despite attempts, and I mean, throwing in a, like, yeah, if your monitor sucks, like, get an just auscultate one, try and palp one.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like, if we're nearing it, we're not getting a blood pressure, and we're showing signs of shitty perfusion, maybe it's time to consider a pressor. You know, again, pain management might be a thing if that is the agitation that's playing into, like, them not being able to get a blood pressure. I don't know. This is kind of a weird picture that's being painted. So
I'm kind of, to me, this whole blood pressure due to compliance thing is just kind of throwing me off, because to me, like, this is what happens when someone blood pressure gets low. The autocuffs tend to kind of fuck up a bit, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we'll dig more into that later, because I kind of have some running theories. But anyway, so Spencer, good point. I am 100% with you. I think a pressor is the direction we probably need to go with this guy. So, however, things take a weird turn. a weirder turn, I guess, at least according to the documentation. So I want to back up just a little bit. As the third leader is, from what I can calculate mathematically, based on the known end time and start times and the total volume delivered, at this point in their documentation, they have about 150 cc's left, okay? And at that point, the crew documents that while they were unable to obtain a blood pressure due to an uncooperative patient, they state that the patient's skin signs and weak palpated pulses, that's a quote, it is not known which pulses, by the way, they weren't like versus radial or carotid or whatever, or femoral, and the crew did not recall when asked, but they say these all indicate signs of poor perfusion. And I agree.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to ask what they mean by uncooperative, because it's such a broad term with like a lot of range. For example, the patient didn't cooperate because they didn't want to, versus the patient didn't cooperate because of a disease process prevented them from doing so.
Yeah.
Strokes, intoxication, like high ammonia levels, hypoxia, hypoperfusion.
Right.
Like
yeah.
Like they're, I guess it's just... It's not a, like, I'm not, they're not painting the picture that they should to really sort of help the, you know, the people reviewing the chart
figure
out, like, what's going on.
Yeah.
But anyway.
What it is, I mean, they are saying, yeah, I mean, you're right. Just documenting uncooperative is way too vague. Vague. But they did. This was clarified in their, I guess, in their debrief when the debrief eventually happened. And basically they're saying is he wouldn't sit still. He was just kind of fidgety and agitated. And they were kind of blaming not being able to get a pressure on that because they're saying, hey, sit still. And he wouldn't sit still. That was their story.
Gotcha. Okay.
And that's why they're not getting blood pressure.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, but even in spite of that, they're saying that, hey, even though I can't get a blood pressure, and I agree with this, they're saying, hey, I don't have a blood pressure, but the skin signs suck. The skin signs, while not documented as this, were later revealed to have slight cyanosis at the fingertips and otherwise pale. And quote, weak palpated pulses, to me, yeah, those are good signs of poor perfusion. I agree. And they even note that at this time, with 150 cc's left of the third liter, that a norepinephrine drip was discussed.
Okay.
Yeah. 5 minutes later, which this bag's going at about 150 cc's in 5 minutes, so it's done in 5 minutes, the crew documents that the third liter is now done, but states that the patient's mentation, because he's alert and oriented times five, as we keep joking, indicates adequate perfusion.
Okay. Well, what about other skin, like other signs, skin signs, heart rate,
yeah,
like any changes there with that? I mean,
oh, so you
maybe
mean
that was what they needed. He just, that 150 was that final push over the top of the hill. I don't
know. So basically, Spencer, what you're asking for is, what about the things just 5 minutes earlier that they said indicated poor perfusion? What about those? Have those changed? No. In fact, they haven't changed at all, Spencer. Those same things that they said indicated poor perfusion still exist. But because he has adequate mentation, they're saying he's fine. This is cherry picking at its finest. Here's what you cannot do in EMS. You cannot say this person is poorly perfusing due to these four signs, but because I have this one sign that they're perfusing fine, I'm going to leech on to that and say that it's okay. You need to consider a whole patient picture, okay? You have to consider them all together. And that's not what they did. At one moment, they're saying, yeah, we should totally talk about an norepi drip because he's not perfusing well at all. And then with no change whatsoever, aside from the fact that now they pretty much have to do a norepi drip, but no change to the patient whatsoever, they're saying he's now fine because his mentation is okay.
Correction, one change.
What's the one?
150 cc's.
Oh, netful. Never mind. Pull over and let him out. He's fixed. All right. But now some crazy shit happens.
Yeah. Now some crazy shit happens. Okay.
Now some crazy shit happens. over the next more than half an hour, there is no documentation of any vital signs. They went from documenting vital signs at like every like 5-7 minutes to documenting nothing. There is, however, one entry. Now, I'm going to kind of briefly describe this charting program. It is not one that I'm familiar with. So I am describing a charting program that I'm not familiar with via the description of someone else. And the way you do vital signs, my understanding is the way you do vital signs in this charting program is you can basically make these entries that are kind of like catch-alls. And it's an entry where you timestamp it. So you type in the time it was done, and then a general box comes up and you have drop downs for vital signs. And then you have a little narrative or note portion where you can write like, you know, performed cardiac monitor or performed IV and that kind of stuff. And that's how you drop it in there. So what they did was they, in half an hour, they did nothing. But they did make one single entry where, again, no vital signs are recorded, but there is a narrative statement in that little narrative box that says how the patient appears to be mentating normally and has no complaints. And they record this note 5 minutes before they finally record more vital signs. And we get crazier. The next set of vital signs. Heart rate is 54.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's down from 119. Heart rate is 54. SAO2, not reading. Blood pressure. Actually, tell you what. I'm going to tell you this, Spence. They got a blood pressure. Guess the ballpark.
I'm going to say 70 systolic.
Okay. No. They still couldn't get one through the automatic cuff, so they had Scone, the EMT new hire.
120 over 80.
Pretty fucking close. They had Scone, the EMT new hire, take a manual blood pressure of 122 over 78. And they document that. And EKG is sinus Brady, and they don't really elaborate much more than that. Mental status, however, has now changed. He is now lethargic, slow to respond, mumbling. So in the notes for this vital sign entry, the crew states they begin to mix their norepinephrine drip due to signs of hypoperfusion, being the altered mental status and the heart rate. And they begin to divert to the next nearest hospital, which is about another 10 minutes in the direction they're already going.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt here and talk about why I think that's a bad idea.
Okay.
I think in this situation, the best thing to do is to either call the sending physician or call the receiving physician, because they know who the patient is. Like, they have that information. They have, you know, the presumably charting information. I don't know if they can, like, has got that from, like, maybe like, you know, like Epic or some other kind of like where they can just transfer it wirelessly.
Sure.
But like, either way, they've gotten a report. They know who this patient is. They know what's going on. So they would be able to offer a treatment course more specified to this particular case. And it doesn't create this huge clusterfuck in the system where a hospital who's expecting a patient doesn't get the patient, and a hospital who has no idea what the fuck is going on suddenly gets like a really sick patient. Maybe diverting is okay, but I really think this is a bad idea without doing those other things, or at least trying to do those other things. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think they just panic buttoned and went for it. So curiously, heart rate continues to be documented, as does EKG interpretations from this point on. They're now back to documenting vitals every 5-10 minutes or so. They only got...
Thank God for that.
Well, and actually, I mean, they only have like two more sets of vitals, though, because they're diverting. So, but anyway...
Oh, yeah, valid.
they note that they place an NRB on the patient, but they are unable to document SATs due to poor waveform, which they also note. And there's really no reading with the poor waveform. Another blood pressure, manual or otherwise, is never listed or obtained. They list their starting dose of norepinephrine at 4 mics per minute. And then in 5 minutes, they titrate that up to 8 mics a minute, again, with no blood pressure. And the heart rate remains bradycardic.
All right. So we should probably assume that the patient didn't improve significantly on that drip. given that none of the other vitals changed. And, you know, honestly, it might even be worthwhile considering like a half milligram of atropine here, mm-hmm. or maybe even like an epi drip as the patient is hypotensive and bradycardic.
I would even consider push dose epi, actually.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's something. I think the other thing I really wonder about is the respiratory status, because that can also cause bradycardia. Like yeah. if the patient's, you know, hypoxic as shit,
right.
they didn't give us in that information you gave, they didn't give us a breath, you know, like the number of times the patient's breathing or yeah. like the quality of those. So I don't know what that status is. Do they need to provide, you know, like respiratory support? Like, what are the patient's lung sounds? CBG.
Right. CBG. Yeah, they never get it. And this is kind of where our information trail breaks off. Gets a little bit more general. So they end up transferring the patient to slightly larger ER in slightly larger city. And the patient ends up remaining at slightly larger ER and survives the ordeal, thankfully.
Hey, all right.
Yeah, he was found to be in severe septic shock upon arrival at the ER. Some additional diagnosis is cardiac dysfunction, in quotes. I imagine his kidney did not do great either. So Spence, there's a lot here. But let's kind of break down some of the bigger issues. So first let's talk about what went wrong with treatment and how should this call have gone. And then let's talk about some system issues that might have led to the hesitant use of norepinephrine. And I have some additional information that I think is going to shed some light on those issues. And finally, let's round off with this. Do we have an issue of integrity here? Because, and here's the thing, like, this is never an accusation that should be taken lightly. And that's why I said what I said at the beginning of the show. But, and we don't take it lightly, but integrity in our very independent line of work is imperative, not just to like this patient or these individuals or even this individual agency, but it's imperative to the industry as a whole. We as EMS providers have so much trust placed upon us because we could get to go out there and do stuff with no one looking over our shoulder. And when we ruin that trust for us, we kind of ruin it for all of us. So this is worth looking into. So,
okay.
And here, and so let's start with the treatment fuck ups and then let's kind of go from there. So
sweet.
But before we even really start, I do want to kind of try and answer one big question. Did the mismanagement from this crew cause the patient to deteriorate? Answer, no idea. I mean, I guess Spencer, like, what do you think?
I think the patient was sick mm-hmm. and I think that they missed some signs that they needed to be more aggressive in their treatment.
Yeah.
But the problem is like, I don't have we just don't have the information here, I think, to really determine, yeah. like, I don't think they helped.
No, you know, they certainly didn't.
If he got an antibiotic like vancomycin or, you know, something that's a little more broad spectrum, it might've actually killed off some of those bacteria and then they die during the transport, releasing those endotoxins, which might have that effect. So yeah, that could be it too.
Okay.
That could be at play. Cause I've seen that happen where we're transporting a patient who's septic and then, their blood pressure has been stable. And then, you know, shortly after antibiotic administration, their blood pressure starts to drop precipitously. And that's just a response to those, you know, like, to the antibiotics doing mm-hmm. their job. But interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah. So again, we don't 100% know, but I can tell you, I don't think they helped. So pain management. Let's start from the top. So the patient strolls in. He appears to be hypoperfusing. Staff says they can't get a blood pressure because, you know, he's agitated and just won't stay still. And they're getting question marks or weird numbers or whatever. So let's say that's true. And the patient is demanding that he needs pain meds and he's angry. And you have reason to believe that he's in a ton of pain because, you know, his foot was, you know, swollen and red. And every time he touched it, he said, ow, profoundly. So once he is in your care from the ER, you know, you're a paramedic, you pick him up, you got to make a choice. And there are a few reasons that pain management may be avoided. For example, Waffles, who was interviewed and asked about this, stated that they did not want to address it because they could not get a blood pressure. The company's pain management protocol gives them the ability to use fentanyl and ketamine. So let's talk a little bit about fentanyl, about hypotension and giving fentanyl. So I can tell you this much. I worked for an agency that was giving morphine and then switched from morphine to fentanyl. And at my agency, they didn't, they kind of just kept it the same. They just changed the name and the dose. They changed the name from morphine to fentanyl and the dose from 2 to 10 milligrams to 50 micrograms. And that was it. Other than that, they still wanted us looking out for blood pressure and those kind of things. Here's the thing.
They kept the protocol the same.
Yeah.
Okay.
They kept the protocol the same. Yeah. No, they didn't just like scratch off the label. That wasn't what I was saying.
I figured I would clarify for the people
good.
At home.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Sorry. The protocol, they kept the same. Yeah, my bad. So anyway, they kept the protocol the same. Because here's the thing. With most of your narcotics, there's an associated histamine release that causes vasodilation. And this vasodilation drops blood pressure. Fentanyl does not have that same histamine release. And so you don't see the same drops in blood pressure. Most of your blood pressure drop with giving fentanyl is actually related to a lack, to a reduction in sympathetic tone. And the sympathetic tone is reduced because the patient's pain is reduced. When you're in pain, sympathetic tone increases, right? Heart rate goes up. Blood pressure goes up. It's a fight or flight response to pain. Your body does this. So if we give you fentanyl and the pain goes away, your body's sympathetic tone relaxes. What fentanyl doesn't really do is it doesn't really prevent your body's natural ability to compensate for shock. For example, hypovolemia, whereas things like morphine may due to the histamine release. So fentanyl, gotcha. So you're going to find that fentanyl, a lot of physicians are far more comfortable giving fentanyl to borderline hypotensive patients than they would be any other narcotic. Okay. But I can see, and here's the thing is, I don't know this agency's pain medicine protocol. I don't. Maybe they have a line where you got to give fentanyl. You can't give fentanyl at, you know, this blood pressure. And if he can't get a blood pressure, he can't give it. I don't know how you feel, Spence, but to me, and well, there's a way around that, but on its face, that's an understandable mistake someone could make. And I'll talk about why it's a mistake, but I can see where someone would be coming from. You know what I mean?
I totally see what you're saying. They're going like, hey, nap, there's a line in the sand and I can't cross that line.
Right. Exactly.
Even though, you actually, you can. And in this case, I think you should.
And you have resources available.
Yeah.
Let's bring it up now, I guess. Physicians. You have a sending physician and you have a receiving physician. Here's the thing is oftentimes I won't comment on exactly how this works because it may be different municipalities. But this question, according to the person that gave us the call, they absolutely could have gotten orders from the sending physician or orders from the receiving physician, to have given fentanyl, if the physician felt that was going to be an okay thing to do. They absolutely could have used the power of the physician to override their own protocols without a physician accompanying. So it would have been that was a tool that was available to them that wasn't used.
Yeah. And if the patient is agitated because they're in a ton of pain and they're not cooperating with the blood pressure because of, of that, then it seems prudent to try and address that issue. You know, like when you call the physician and you go like, hey, here's the thing. This gentleman's in a lot of pain. He didn't receive any narcotic pain medications from the, sending facility. I think we need to give him some. It's making it hard to complete an assessment, sell it.
Yeah.
Sell the reason you want to do it with clinical backing. Absolutely. That's one way to do it. But the other medication also would have been actually, I think, appropriate here.
The ketamine. Yeah.
Ketamine. This is kind of like this is almost a perfect situation for ketamine.
Oh, it is. It's
potentially.
Wonderful.
Potentially.
Yeah, so the ketamine, right. Ketamine is kind of perfect for this because we've talked about this in the past. Ketamine, with the exception of one scenario, and I'll talk about that, ketamine is blood pressure supportive. It's not only going to treat this guy's pain, it's also going to help with the anxiety as well. So it's kind of a double whammy on this guy. And I think it's perfect to give in this case. So ketamine actually causes a release of catecholamines, and this will actually drive blood pressure up when ketamine is given. Now, the only scenario where that's not the case is in a catecholamine depleted scenario, but your catecholamines are like your norepinephrine and your epinephrine. Okay. So in a scenario where someone is catecholamine depleted, then ketamine will drop blood pressure and it can be a problem. So there's a couple things that will cause someone to be catecholamine depleted. And one of those things is going to be prolonged sepsis. And the way you can tell someone is catecholamine depleted and prolonged sepsis is you're going to start seeing like onset of like bradycardia, lethargy, those kind of things. Yeah. Basically, not this dude. So if you have a patient...
Not that dude at the time that they should have treated.
Right, exactly. I mean, later on. But yeah, so... I mean, and again, I don't know if that's what happened to that guy. But anyway, so yeah, it's one of those things where if someone is doing catecholamine things, like tachycardia, agitation, then they have catecholamines. They are not catecholamine depleted. So ketamine, I think for this guy, was definitely on the table. And so I think it, now given he might have a protocol that says you must give fentanyl first before you give ketamine. I had a protocol like that. You could not jump straight to ketamine. But again, physicians were available and physicians were in use. Here's kind of what it comes down to. Treating the guy's pain and anxiety needed to become a focus and a discussion at some point. I can't claim to have the exact perfect answer for a system I don't work in with physicians I don't know and a patient that wasn't mine. But what I can say is that this crew, at least per their documentation and what we were told, did not really address the anxiety and pain of the patient. If what they're saying about the blood pressure, which to me is a critical piece of this patient picture, is the blood pressure. If the reason they're saying they could not grab that critical piece is patient agitation and moving around and not being cooperative to sit still, then you better damn well have great documentation of how you address that problem, of how you tried to address that barrier. They don't have that.
Yeah.
So anyway, but let's kind of move on to the norepi use.
Oh yeah.
So, yeah, I think before we get into like why norepi use is good for this call, like physiologically, let's talk a little bit about this whole blood pressure thing. And this might move into the integrity talk after this. I'll tell you this, Spence, right off the bat, I'm curious what you think. I think this guy had a low blood pressure the entire time. I think the reason they were getting ? Over ? And weird, wacky numbers is because he was hypotensive. Because in my experience, when here's the thing, by the nature of a low blood pressure, it generates less of a pulse. It's harder for machinery and humans to detect.
Yeah.
I think the reason the machines were coming up with wacky numbers, and I would so want to know what those wacky numbers are, but nobody knows them, nobody has them, and the crew does not, in quotes, remember. But I think the guy's blood pressure was low the whole time. Here's why I think so. And Spencer, if you disagree, let me know. But like, here's why I think. First of all, poor skin signs.
You brought those up earlier, like cyanosis of the nail beds, pale skin, pallor. I mean, it doesn't paint a good picture of a perfusing person.
Certainly doesn't. He's agitated. Agitation can be a sign of poor perfusion.
It can. It's sort of a vague term in the way they used it, because they talked about it. It's sort of initially, it was sort of hinted that like the patient was just in pain and like not cooperating. And then later it was sort of like, well, I mean, for us, we kind of read through it as a sign of poor perfusion, but they seem to just kind of count that. And maybe that's, you know, like that pain medication bias that kind of came in. They're like, ah, it's a drug seeker.
True.
He's going to be shitty. And he's going to be agitated because we're not doing the thing that he wants, which we feel would be bad for him, you know, or whatever. I mean, that's a big presumption on my part. I don't know these guys. I don't know, you know, what.
Sure.
But that's, I can see that happening. And I think that's sort of a bad thing, because like, there's all this other evidence that sort of points towards like agitation in this situation might have actually just been like a really bad perfusion issue because, you know, like his brain is grumpy that it's not getting the shit it needs.
I think in this case, like, there's a lot of reasons for this guy to be agitated. I would be agitated if I was in this much pain, don't get me wrong, but it's kind of one of those things to where it's like it's agitation plus everything else. And, exactly. And at that point, to me, that's when it's one of those things where it's like, it could be nothing. It could be something. I can't discount it, you know?
Yeah.
And also he has, as they quote, weak peripheral pulses. And here's the big reason that I think the blood pressure was low the entire time. This is the big one. The reason why. So here's the thing. It is possible to have poor peripheral perfusion, the cyanotic fingers, whatnot, and still have a decent mean arterial pressure, okay? What can happen, for example, let's say the body becomes hypovolemic due to diarrhea or blood loss, whatever. Let's say they become hypovolemic. What'll happen is vasoconstriction is going to occur in the extremities, and it's going to start small, right? It's going to start fingers. So while your blood pressure cuff placed on the upper arm is showing a solid map, your fingers could still have very little blood flow because the vasculature is cramping down. So it would be entirely possible to have cyanosis at the fingertips and still an okay blood pressure. However, sepsis changes the game. Septic patients are hypotensive due to something called pathological vasoplegia. In other words, vasculature becomes dilated and the body is not able to vasoconstrict. So as a result, one of the three pillars of blood pressure crumbles, and that's the container size. It gets too big to fill. Okay, you don't have enough volume to fill it, and the pump can't work hard enough to fill it, so your blood pressure drops. On top of that, when you have this vasoplegia, the capillaries become very leaky, and this allows significant fluid loss into the surrounding tissues. So the second pillar crumbles. You start losing volume as well. This gives your body one thing to do to keep up the blood pressure. And that's the final pillar, the pump. And the pump, your heart, is going to work its ass off to keep that blood pressure up until it can't do it anymore. It'll go as hard as it can until you die. So this could, which, hey, but anyway. So basically what's happening there, what's happening in this case, when they're septic, if you have those cyanotic fingertips, this is the reason why I don't think his blood pressure was ever normal, is that sepsis usually means that peripheral constriction is not occurring, meaning that his body is unable to keep a blood pressure. So those poor skin signs are not due to the body shunting blood to where it needs to be, but rather they're due to a systemic failure and inability to vasoconstrict. So that is why I think this guy's blood pressure was never low.
Yeah, those are really solid points. I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Yeah. And so let's kind of talk about what this guy should have gotten treatment wise. So first off, Spence, I think you and I probably both agree, fluid right off the bat is the right answer.
Yep. Fluid, antibiotics. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely the right answer. I mean, obviously the antibiotics are going to go ahead and attack the bacterium, although apparently it may release endotoxins and murder the patient, but the bacteria has to be stopped. Otherwise,
attempted.
The patient, yeah. It, well, because it's one of those things where it's like, if you do nothing about it, then they will certainly die. So you might as well do the thing where they will, the only thing they can possibly save their life. And that is going to be the antibiotics. But here's the thing is, if you were just to go straight depressors on this person, while again, the main problem with sepsis is the vasoplegia, if you were to go straight depressors and not replenish that volume on this guy, then you're not going to really help him out. All you're going to do is create a huge amount of vascular resistance and not refill the actual fluid in the system. So you really need to start with a lot of fluid. Now, in their protocol, so, Spencer, you were citing 30 milliliters per kilogram. We don't know how much this guy weighs. In their protocol, they have a specific line is after 2 liters, they're supposed to consider pressors.
I was going to say, like, and that's on their, like, I'm imagining that's their 911 protocol. Does that cross over to interfacility? Because interfacility is sort of a different game in a way.
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of asking questions I don't have answers to at this point, but that is their 911 protocol. My understanding, at least from talking with the person who gave us this call, my understanding is that kind of once they leave the ER, they pretty much use their 911 protocols for anything until they can get, like, if they need to contact a physician and change course, they can do that if it's going to be outside of their protocol. But generally speaking, once they take off from the hospital, they continue the treatments from the hospital. And if they got to change course, they use their protocols.
Okay.
So that was kind of, so anyway, so it was kind of expected that they would be giving this third leader, though, I would say, because they were leaving the hospital with the third leader started. So I don't really blame them for that. And their protocol is soft in this area, where it just says consider pressors after the second leader. So
gotcha.
Yeah, it doesn't really provide them with a lot of the guidance. And that kind of might move in to some of the systemic problems with this whole thing. OK, Spence, so let's talk integrity. I'll be upfront. There are some things about this that just don't make a ton of sense. There are also some things that I know about some of the system issues and some of the interview later on that I'll kind of get out of the way. During the interview of Waffles, the paramedic, that name still makes me laugh. during the interview of Waffles, the paramedic, a lot of questions were kind of brought up. He could not remember, you know, he kept saying, oh, it was coming up with wacky numbers. Like, okay, well, were they low? Like, what were the wacky numbers? I don't remember. And they started asking him questions about the norepi protocol. And one of the questions that came up was, did he really know how to mix the norepi? There are some things that really indicated that he was just not comfortable with the norepi protocol. And for me, the issues of integrity for me kind of come up in spots where, for example, you have like a long period of time where no vital signs are documented. The last thing you do document before vital signs goes bad is kind of, to me, it comes off. And again, like, I'm very cautious when I say this, but to me, it comes off as, look, everything's fine. Everything was fine the entire time until right 5 minutes before this random thing happened. It kind of looks like, and it paints the picture, and I think this is the part to me that makes it necessary that we ask the integrity question. When you have a big gap in any documented monitoring of a patient, and then the very next thing is the patient is doing poorly, why that big gap is there, that's a question that's got to be asked. Now,
yeah,
here's kind of the other thing that comes up, and this is one of the things that I learned from Dr. QA QI committee. He's like, hey, like, is it possible? Like, how do you guys do vital signs? Like, why would they not have that there? And according to them, the process is typically they get done at the end of the call and they just print it off the monitor and they go and they write it in, which is what this crew said they did. And the monitor, they should have had at least a heart rate. There is no, and the monitor would have recorded it, and the monitor, and it records the heart rate off the EKG. So even if they were getting a sat reading, they should still have the heart rate. And the heart rate was the big thing that popped up. That was the big difference aside from his mentation.
Yeah.
And there's really no good reason that they should not have recorded those particular vitals.
I think this is a really, like, as I've kind of alluded to throughout the episode, like, there's a lot of vague things in their charts.
Right.
Like, and there's a lot of inconsistent things that they're describing. And that really sort of, like, the problem with documenting, you know, rightly so, like, hey, I'm really worried about this patient's perfusion, right?
Right.
I mean, they basically were like, Jesus, his skin looks like shit. We haven't been able to get a blood pressure.
Yeah.
And they painted what probably is the most accurate picture that they painted throughout their charting.
Yeah.
And came to the right conclusion. But then the next thing they do is they're like, oh, you know what? Mentation's fine. This is all fine.
Everything's fine. It's fine.
I'm fine. How are you?
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of...
Exactly.
And then they're like, yeah, it's good. And then for 30 minutes, we don't see anything. And
actually, 34 minutes, if we want to get specific.
34 minutes.
Yeah.
Thanks, 122 over 78. 30 minutes was fine. Don't... And then they're like, yeah, it's not great. I mean, like, blood pressure's okay, maybe, but, like, everything else is garbage. So I think that's the problem, is, like, when you have that gap in there and you have these two, like, wildly different patients, it kind of goes, everyone goes, like, okay, so there's 30 minutes where, like, what happened, like... went on?
Because it looks like
they can't account for it.
It looks like the patient died in these 30 minutes, and no one wrote anything down.
Yeah, like, was, did you decide they were okay? And yeah, it's just those kind of things, those kind of gaps lead to questions about integrity. Yeah. You know, just by being there. So I think the big takeaway is, like, when you're documenting, try and document consistently, try and document clinical findings that support the actions that you're taking, you know, like, because that's what you should be doing, is you should be letting your clinical findings, you know, support the procedures, protocols, you know, that you're going down. And that needs to kind of reflect in your charting. So I think they were very, I think, you know, my honest opinion on this, without knowing these guys, and so it could be wrong, is that they didn't know what to do, and they got done with the call, and they kind of went like, oh God, we should have done things sooner, because yeah. Hindsight's always 20/20. And then they went like, God, I can't document this, because right. Now it's so obvious, so I just won't.
I just lose these things. And that's where it kind of comes up. And again, like, I'm very cautious when I start talking about integrity, because not only integrity is important to the industry, but it's also important that you don't ever, like, falsely accuse someone of not having it. I think in the best case scenario, in order for this to be an honest attempt, they would have had to have honestly believed that the blood pressures they were getting were inaccurate due to the patient's agitation and not holding still. Yeah, this was a patient that could totally hold still for two large bore IVs. They would have to honestly have forgotten whatever wacky numbers were coming over. They would have had to honestly forgotten to document vital signs that they for a specific period of time right before something bad happened, which, by the way, they apparently sit down at the charting system. They had the vital signs in front of them and they just start entering. And so they would have to have, like, honestly just not entered vital signs that they had in front of them for 30 minutes prior to something bad happened. To me, there are a lot of things that have to line up for these to be honest mistakes. And that's why I asked the question of integrity. And it's one of these things. I am not bringing this part up in this call to say that these people were disingenuous. Again, I have one half of a call that I was not a part of. Okay. But I am bringing it up. I am bringing it up as a statement, I guess, to the EMS community at large, is that integrity is important. And I know I said this earlier in the episode, but it's worth saying again. We are trusted. We're trusted by the public and we're trusted by physicians. If one of us looks bad, then all of us look bad. And this is, and losing our integrity, losing that honesty and that trust would hurt the industry in ways that, that you don't want. So don't do it. Be honest. Even if it means being wrong, be honest. So, let's see. So one last thing I want to talk about. One of the main things that the person brought up is they feel that the end result of their agency's investigation really leaned heavily on the paramedics making mistakes. And they feel that there were some system issues that were not addressed. One of the things that kind of looks like to me is I see a crew that really, really, really didn't want to start a norepi drip. That is kind of a picture that I got a little bit from that. Cause to me, like, that's kind of why I'm seeing, like, so why are we trying to, cause to me, it looks like they're pushing hard to justify at one point that this patient is perfusing just fine by coming up with, like, oh, well, he's mentating fine, so we can ignore everything else. And I'm like, why? What's driving that? What's driving that push to ignore these other signs that you very so clearly stated and then focus on this one thing and not start norepi? And it kind of came down to this is, like I had mentioned earlier, during their interview of Waffles is uncomfortable with norepinephrine. And here's the fact of the matter is norepinephrine was a new drug. Well, it's not a new drug, but it was newly added to their protocol, is starting norepi drips. So this was a new drug, and they had actually kind of changed a lot of their, they had recently added push dose epinephrine and norepinephrine to the repertoire of hypotension. And the way the agency went about integrating this was they pretty much just changed the protocol, and they sent everyone a PDF of the protocol, And that was it. There was no quarterly training. There was none of this stuff. And a lot of the powers that be were like, well, yeah, but like we change protocols all the time. But one of the things that the company does not do a lot of, while they do have drips in their protocol before this, they just, in the course of their daily practice, most of the drips they do are just continuations of whatever the hospital has going. And they very rarely are asked to acutely assess for the need of medication infusions. And so there's not a lot of hands-on practice in terms of mixing norepinephrine and that, like mixing it and then hooking it up to a pump and then giving it and then adjusting the rate and those kind of things. There's just not a lot. And so now we have a paramedic who was basically told one day recently, just prior to this call, that, hey, you can do this now. And here it is written down. And I am gonna agree. I think that is a system that has kind of put Waffles in a situation to fail. And Waffles never fail, okay? Waffles never fail the police. But in this case, the Waffles did. The Waffles failed. So yeah, it's one of those things where I agree. That is a huge system issue. You can't just change a protocol and say, this is new now. Good luck, especially when it's something like that. Now, if you're just changing like a dose, like let's say you've always given it at a certain rate, and then you're saying, hey, guys, now we can give it at this rate. I would say you don't need to have a big meeting about that. You know, I mean, or at least you don't really need to do like hardcore training. You need to make sure the information gets out there. But when you're talking about, hey, like we're going to introduce a completely new medication, completely new drip, you really need to focus on what I really like to do is get everyone trained up and run people through scenarios where they have to integrate these medications. And that kind of puts the medication into their thought process as they go through.
I think it's worthwhile doing the, like, you know, like you get to touch it. You have to set it up. You have to actually go through the physical steps of starting, you know, mixing the medication, et cetera, because that way you can identify, you know, for yourself, you know, as a practicing medic, like what of these steps can trip me up? Because, you know, that is how you develop that kind of comfort with it. And so that's not another thing that's adding to your list, because I'm like, I'm reluctant to do things for patients. You know, like there's a part of me that goes like, but doing this means that they're sick, and they're sick, that means I have to do more things. Like, don't be sick. Like, that's a natural thing to want. Having more of those steps where you're like, I've never done that before.
Exactly.
You know, that's another barrier to doing what ultimately needed to be done. So I agree with your assessment. I think if it sounds like they kind of kicked this out without recognizing, like, hey, people, it, you know, like it's a new process or whatever, you know, like, then the system failed the medics 100%. In that case.
One of the things that if you are in a position of leadership at your company, one thing that I would always recommend is the substitution test. This is a great way to help identify system issues. And here's what a substitution test is. All right, so you got Waffles and you've got his call. Go find someone that is distinctly not Waffles and bring them in. Give them a similar scenario, or basically some scenario where they would have to exercise their use of that medication, which is where Waffles failed, and see how well they do. If you find widespread confusion and discomfort with it, like they're like, I don't know how to mix it either, that kind of stuff, or, and they're hesitating, that's a good identifier that you have a system issue. Yeah. And it's really something that should be done. I do not know if that was done at this agency, but it is a good way to try and test for a system issue. So that's all I have on this big tangled mess of a call.
this certainly was.
Jesus.
Well, Chris, take this out awkwardly.
No. All right. That's all I got. The return of the cardiac scream is what we're calling that. Everybody, go ahead and follow us on Facebook, EMS20/20. We are at EMS2020 Show on Instagram and EMS2020podcast@gmail.com. And with that, I already took us out awkwardly. Now it's super awkward.
Now it's really awkward. You've lingered.